focus group to look at the antennas while people are still working on the radio receiver, that might be really good.
Yeah, well, that's something that, you know, perhaps I would certainly be. I have some experience that and opinions now about that. So
yeah, I think that could be very good.
I hope. Is my audio okay? I'm using the mic in the laptop.
Yeah, your audio sounds fine, Rob.
Okay, good. The whole, I think there's a good reason to, in fact, we're at the stage where I think we're going to go and actually design a new LNA, because nothing out there seems to be well designed. I mean, it's amazing, but the Clifton mini-whip system that he's using is seems to be really injecting all kinds of common mode CRUD into his receiver. So anyway, hopefully with this process, John may come out with some insights that could translate into a companion product to the tangerine.
So what exactly is this setup right now that's causing the trouble?
Well, in his case, and I've seen this elsewhere, I've had this problem, is that, there's the antennas. In his case, he's using DX Engineering Clifton mini whip, e-field probe type approach, which is a whip antenna that has a high Z input, JFET input amplifier out there. And it pretty much appears like the power injector, the bias T that injects the power is injecting so much common mode noise that's getting translated into differential noise by imbalances in the feed lines and so on. That he's got maybe 30 dB worse signals, higher noise than I think he should have. I mean, 30 dB. I mean, really, it's that bad. So
yeah, that is not a good situation.
And I think it's not a very common. I mean, Glenn Elmore, N6GN, who's kind of my mentor in things RF, has been working with me and John. And John, at other sites, Glenn has seen similar problems. And you peel the onion on this, and you can get down close to ITU noise levels, even in suburban environments. So if you're going to do, if you want to measure ionospheric noise, I think you need to get rid of all these other sources of all of this interference. It's kind of self-generated. So the ground currents in the AC line and the neutral line of your house wiring just inject, even if it's only a millivolt of noise there. With these receivers we have that are so sensitive, that's enough to generate, minus 90, minus 80, might sometimes minus 70 dBm across 50 ohms. So, you should be at minus 120, minus 115. I mean, I'm talking on 3 kilohertz bandwidth. So you're if you put your receiver in upper sideband, the background noise level ought to be, it's S0, so it's or something like that. But I never use S meters readings there. I don't even understand them very well. But so I do it all in dBm, and either in root hertz or 3 kilohertz bandwidth. So at our site at KPH and at K7 OEI, the background noise level is maybe 10 dB above KTB, which is, you know, minus 160, minus 161, and that's 13 dB above KTB. And so that's what we aim for. It's, so in a 1 hertz, that's, you know, minus 161, and, you know, 10 kilohertz bandwidth, that would be, you know, minus 120. So it's a, and that's, you know, that's how we measured the galactic noise, because the
user entered your channel.
The noise we saw was, you know, minus 160, minus 159. So it's only 1 or 2 dB above our background noise level at KPH. But I think a lot of people might be able to get close to that. Anyway, I digress. We should start our call soon, I think.
Yes, that sounds good. We should be starting pretty soon.
Nathaniel, are you hearing backup noise? Should I mute my mic, or is it okay to me leave it open?
I think it'd be best to mute it. I could hear some car noise there. So yeah, mute it. And I use the right shift key as a push-to-talk button on my computer.
Is there a push-to-talk button on this this TeamSpeak app?
There is. If you go under Tools and then Options, you can, one of the panels there, I think under Capture, there's a push to talk that you can set.
This one seems to mute it right here.
Well, hello everyone. Welcome to the October 8th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KD0S, and this week I've been doing, school has gotten busy. I think I had more grading to do, so I think Nathan can identify with that. So I haven't done a huge amount, although I have been playing with GPSD and a few other things, and learning some of the quirks of those pieces of software, that piece of software, and have been doing a little bit of testing on communication protocols within a local host that have some robust natures to them. So let's go down the list. Next on the list is Mike, AA8K, shown as recording in a way. And we thank Mike for posting the recordings to tsarchive.tangerine.com. TangerineSDR.com. Next on the list, we have Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, David. How are you? Pleasure to be here this evening. Things are going fine. Here in Scranton. It's just been kind of wet and messy. I did get on the HF radio this week. I finally made a few QSOs using FT8, which I've wanted to do for a while. I finally did it with the help of learned some things from my neighbor, Jim Igo. I can't remember his call at the moment. Things are very, very busy with classes and trying to do project administration and things like that. But it is coming together. I'm going to be making some very good headway on the HAMSI workshop within the next week or two. So hopefully we'll have some more information on that out very soon. I know Bill Engelke, he has done quite a bit with revisions of the local host specifications. So thank you for the people who sent those comments in. And I believe he sent a version 1.0 of the document out to the list. So I think that's it for me for now. So W2NAF, back to the group.
Fine business, Nathan. And I do want to mention that Bill asked me to post that 1.0 document to the Tangerine SDR documents list, and I did that, and I moved the old document to the back versions. Also, this weekend, I spent a little bit of time updating the video list, and as the DCC videos become available, I am putting those up on the list. I've done a little reorganization, so just a comment. Next on the list, we have Ned, AA7A. So go ahead, Ned.
Okay, yeah, Dave, thanks. Some names on here are new to me. I'm intermittently joining this group. I represent the ARRL noise study project that Ed Hare joined your channel. Heads up.
Hello.
I'm the lead kind of architect for the system that will be installed out at our remote antenna site in southeastern Arizona, Safford, Arizona. And in the past week, we had a big event. We executed the calibration of our receiving antenna system to a known standard, a reference, the MCO 6502 loop antenna, which Ed uses often in his EMC work. We came up with a process to essentially compare the gain of our receiving antenna system to that of the calibrated loop, so that we have some basis for claiming the strength of signals received with our noise study system. At the moment, we're planning to use the AirSpy Plus HF SDR receiver. I tested it here on my bench, my lab here at home, before I took off, and I'm quite impressed with that that receiver. I have lots of other SDR objects, you know, RF FunCube dongle. I've got RF Space SDRQ and other stuff, and this AirSpy really is the best I've ever seen. And there's some discussion before the start about noise. I have a lot to tell you about that. That sounds to me 100% like overload. That the antenna you're connecting to it is picking up lots of signals, not just the ones you want to hear, but others you don't know about, and you're overloading the A to D is just getting creamed. And the solution is not a better antenna. Well, maybe put a paperclip there, go away. But the solution is better design of preselects filters in the front end, and that's what AirSpy does really well. I've tested all the other ones I have, and they all struggle without the use of add-on preselects to get rid of broadcast and all the other stuff that puts lots and lots of volts into your front end. The preselect filters help you manage the power going into the mixer or the A to D so that everything remains linear. I've seen it so many times. I'm a retired communications engineer from General Dynamics and Motorola. A lot of hours in the lab under my belt, so I've seen this kind of stuff a lot. So at any rate, the calibration process is a big success. We have quite an interesting antenna out there. I generally report. I sent it to Enzerway-X Award, and anybody else is interested in it, maybe he can post it where it needs to be. But the idea here is to come up with a way of calibrating antennas that are used in these sort of in your like your weather station and other systems that may want to have some substantiation of the capabilities of the receiving equipment. So that's it for this round. I can't stay long. I have another telecon after this, but I'll hang in here for the dialogue this afternoon or this evening. Back to Ned.
Fine business, Ned, and thanks for the information. Next on the list, we have Rob, AI6VN. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi. Hello, everyone. And I think you overheard at the beginning I was talking about noise and sensitivity. That's an area of particular interest to me. I've been deploying and over the last year refining the receiver systems at KPH, which is a historic radio site out north of San Francisco, out on the coast, where we have an extraordinarily quiet receive site right on the Pacific coast that was actually established by Marconi and Dr. Beveridge back in the 20s. And that system I would love to calibrate. So I'm very interested, Ned, in any of the information. you can that those systems are available, so you can open them up. Those are all Kiwi SDRs. There's a bank of seven of them at the moment, so there's almost always a channel available. In the high frequency, there's two antenna systems, but primarily the high frequency one is a TCI 530 commercial antenna, omnidirectional log periodic, kind of aimed at up at the 45 degrees, so it's not a DX antenna really. But we're typically number four in the Whisper spot list here in the United States, so it's very quiet. And the Kiwi does have, or excellent, we have filtering in front of it. Go into all of that. In this case, we have a custom designed high pass filter that chops off the AM broadcast band and lets 160 through. So I've done a lot of work there in the last year to get that system so the noise level's low and never overloads. There's still a little bit of work. Occasionally we get some overloads, but basically the background noise level is around the high frequency bands, 20 meters and above, about minus 161 in 1 hertz. So 10 dB above KdB, 10 or no, 13 dB above KdB. So that's kind of what I aim for, and I was think it's something useful for as part of a personal weather station. I was telling Nathaniel earlier before this call that I think it's the antenna system and calibrating it is especially important. So I'm very interested in the calibration process, and I'd like to learn more about what you've done down there and see, compare it against what we have at KPH. I'd be interested to get your feedback. So maybe we can talk offline sometime. And that's all. I am interested. I don't know if anybody got a chance. I did post up some stuff about digital down conversion last week, some research papers, and I don't know that who would be the person to look into that, but I do have Dr. Fred Harris from who's the author of those papers has volunteered to collaborate with us if we want to try to implement his digital filter techniques, which potentially could improve the signal noise ratio of an SDR, both reduce the complexity of the FPGA implementation as well as improve the signal noise ratio by reducing the rounding errors associated with concatenated filters, CIC type filters. So that's about as much as I know how to do, though, and that technically I can help engineer, introduce people, but I can't do much to help and implement that. But those are the areas of interest to me. If I can be of any help, I'll be monitoring on both antennas and the digital filtering part.
Well, thanks, Rob. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thank you very much, Dave, and thanks for doing the yeoman work on running this session and the web page too. And I don't know if you got my note. It looks like the logo has disappeared off the main page, but they're on the video page, but they're just placeholders on the main page. So I don't know what happened there. Maybe they got moved or instead of copied. Anyway, looks very good. I like it much cleaner and easier to follow where the videos are coming from and where you're going to, where they appeared first, I guess. And congratulations, Ned, to getting your antenna calibrated. I'm interested in that, too, and I'm sure Nathaniel will be very interested, as well as Rob. And thank you, Rob, for posting that that article from Fred. I did manage to find one online that seemed like it was a cut-down version, but the one that he shared with us was the full version. It was very, very good, although it's a hard slog to get through it. And I definitely would be interested in working with him on implementing his polyphase filters the way he described in his article, because I think it's going to be very useful to us. So meanwhile, I'm still trying to get my dipole fixed and back up so I can get on in the NAQCC extravaganza tomorrow night. So we're having fun with that amongst all the other SDR stuff. So that's about it for work here. Back over to you, Dave.
Fine business, Scotty, and I did fix those icons while I was sitting here listening. So next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, thank you, Dave. Okay, so this last week, I worked a little bit with the Odroid N2, reinstalled an updated operating system, and I'm still kind of working on getting the Lin HPSDR program running. I think the idea was that we might consider that as the controller for the radio or the software for the radio. And I'm not so sure that's going to work because it's an interesting little thing that John Melton kludged together for Lin HPSDR. It actually uses three fairly major libraries, two of which are not very efficient. So I'm really wondering whether they're going to work well on single board computers. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Say, Dan, I have a suggestion. Have you tried compiling the Pi HPSDR code on yours? Since it was originally for a Raspberry Pi, it might work better on the M2.
Yes, I actually do have it up and running on a Raspberry Pi, and it's actually one that's connected to the Raspberry Pi Foundation. I think it's about a 7-inch monitor, and it works pretty well. We actually did that as a demo at the Intel Altera show probably 3 years ago.
Yeah,
longer than that, Dan. Sorry, go ahead, Dave.
I've used both of those, and I understand exactly what you're talking about, that the Lin HPSDR is for a more or less normal Ubuntu Linux, and it assumes GTK 3 now, so that would be a challenge maybe on the M2 to get it well compiled. There's some other libraries, as you say, so I just thought that might be something to think about. But we can I did want to mention one last thing to both Scotty and Rob. Some of the things in WDSP, Fred Harris's polyphase code is in there, but not the specific one in the paper that was sent. So Warren Pratt, who wrote WDSP, and it was a cleaned up version of the DTTSP that Bob and Frank wrote. So if you have an interest in what's going on there, I would take a look at WDSP and see how it's written. And that can be found on John Milton's website. One that will compile on Linux, Mac, and Windows. Then we still have Christine. So Christine's been quietly sitting there waiting. So Christine, KD8OXT. Go ahead, Christine.
Hi, here's Christina, KD8OXT. I also have Rob, AC8YV, with Hello. Me here. Hi, Rob. Let's see. I just came back from WW0WWV, so that was the big news in the past couple of weeks. And WWV a year ago was considered at risk of federal defunding and now no longer is. And we had a big party about it. And also we collected a bunch of data for the standard station receiver side of the CDER grant. So that's been the big news in the past couple of weeks. And Rob, you bought an Odroid, I think.
Yeah, I brought an Odroid N2. I got the 4 gig option because that'll probably be what we want, right? It's on pre-order. I have no idea what that means. I'm just going to let it eventually get to me. And then I will play around with operating system distribution stuff and see if I can't set up a nice way to package all the software we'll want after we start having some of that software. And as far as I know, that's what you guys want me for. So if there's anything else, let me know. But I'll be starting off with that.
All right, that's our updates to start with. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business. So I think we've talked to everybody on the net and gotten updates, so we're open for general discussion.
I have one other announcement that I forgot to mention earlier. This is W2NAF.
You can go ahead at open discussion, you just take off.
All right. I was interviewed earlier this week on Neil Rapp's Ham Talk Live. So that was a podcast, and I got to talk about the festival frequencies that the Case Western people were doing, and of course the Personal Space Weather Station as well. So if you want, you can go ahead and listen to Neil's podcast this week, and I'll be on it.
Do you have a link you can post down at the bottom?
Yeah, give me a second. I'll post it.
I have a question for Rob. Rob, darn, I forgot your call. Rob, there with Christina. When you said do a, and I'm having a brain fade here, but you're doing a Linux package. I mean, like a distro. So would it be possible to do a distribution that would just include all of our software and the build of Linux and be like a Tangerine build or a Personal Space Weather Station build, one of those two?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm hoping. My call sign is AC8YV, a cat eat your vegetables. What I'm hoping for is what's called a Debian blend, which is just, well, in the pure sense, it's a specific subset of Debian packages that have been upstreamed. We probably won't need to or want to go that far. So we'll have a set of Debian packages. We'll have a set of Debian packages we may have contributed upstream to be included in all Debian variants, potentially, if somebody wants it. And we'll have a bunch of our own packages. Those will live on our own repository, and we'll be able to get people to do updates pretty easily if we do it that way. We definitely want to play nicely with the Debian package management system if we're going to be running in Debian.
So this is as opposed to having our own distro. We would just use Debian and then list the dependencies and then have a bunch of packages that the people can use to do the functions that we need to do for the weather station.
Right, exactly. So if somebody doesn't want the Space Weather Station but does want the Tangerine SCR or something else, they just uninstall those packages. That's what we're hoping for. That's probably the best way to deal with this. It's definitely going to be the easiest thing to maintain.
Yeah, that'd be very nice.
Another thing that Debian's infrastructure lets us do is we can do lots of testing to make sure that our various packages work nicely with or without each other. So if something acts differently with or without another package, we can detect that. And if that's not intended, we can fix it. We can also make sure that we're getting the right dependencies installed. All of our packages should be able to work on Ubuntu variants. So if you want to do some Tangerine SDR stuff on the desktop, it shouldn't be hard or impossible at all. There might be some extra modifications that people need to do for that because Ubuntu does have some differences. And, you know, between variants, different versions of Ubuntu and between different versions of Debian, there are going to be some compatibility issues. But that kind of work is pretty standard in the community, and people have been doing that for a long time. And we don't have to care about it.
Yeah, okay, because to me, the biggest bane of Linux is package dependencies and things like that, things that won't work with a higher version but will work with a lower version, and then the next thing you load requires the higher version, but you don't have that because you need to use it need to have the lower version for some other application, and then you get caught in a bind.
Yeah, that's probably why you want to use Debian for this, because you start off with a stable set of libraries and so on that you can then build a system out of. Debian has Debian will backport an awful lot of things to use older versions of libraries if it can be done trivially, and if not, they'll have newer versions of those dependencies installable, hopefully co-installable with the old versions. They do a pretty good job of making that all work. So that's why so many things are based on Debian, is you can build the system you want out of that set of packages, or even include your own if you need a particular version. So that's probably the right way to do that.
Okay, well, that sounds good. I'm definitely not the Linux packaging expert by any means, so I'll defer to you guys to do that, but that sounds like it would work very smoothly that way.
Yeah, this is what I do at my day job, so that shouldn't be an issue. If you have questions, come to me, but let's get some software first so we can actually have actual examples of what to do instead of purely academic exercises, because that's not something that we need to do right now.
Yeah, Dan, I don't know if I mentioned, but the guy that bought the HF2 last week finally got it working, and he's pointed him to the Tangerine list here, and he's watching that now because he wants to do and Nathaniel, you might know about this. He's monitoring Jovian storms, Jupiter storms on Jupiter, and he wants to listen to 15 to 30 megahertz, the whole spectrum all at once. And he can't really do that with the HF2, but he will be able to do it with the Tangerine. So he's much interested.
I think that's very similar to the Radio Jove project, which is a citizen science project for monitoring Jovian emissions. I think they've the official hardware that they support. They have two versions. They have more or less a single frequency version that's listening at around 20.1 megahertz. But now they also have a spectrogram version of their hardware, which is supposed to look at a wideband spectra. Over.
Yeah, okay. Like I said, he wanted 15 megahertz. HF2 could give him only a couple of megahertz. And maybe Rob can answer this. The Kiwis are broadbanded, I think. What kind of spectrum can you get, simultaneous spectrum can you get out of a Kiwi, a single board?
You're hearing me. The Kiwi does 0 to 30 megahertz. You could, I think 1,000 bin FFT. So when you're zoomed all the way out, each bin is 30 kilohertz wide, I think. And of course, they're not rectangular frequency responses. And this is one of the areas in which Fred Harris's algorithm could benefit the Kiwi, although I don't think that'll ever happen. But I'm hoping that the frequency response, you know, of a CIC filter is non-uniform. So you don't really get you get several dB of error across the whatever the bandwidth you set is, and then you have to put in compensation filters that compensate for the CIC filters. There's all kinds of complexity. That's about the limit of my understanding of it. But the Kiwi is fine, and you can look at, if you open up KPHSDR, just go to that kphsdr.com, and you'll see, you can zoom all the way out and see 0 to 30 megahertz in one fell swoop. There is a high-pass filter there at 1.8 megahertz, so you'll see very little below 1.8 megahertz, but the rest of it is, and then you can zoom in, at any spectrum within that, you can zoom all the way down to 200 hertz wide if you want.
Okay, so when you're zoomed out like that, I presume then the FFT is done in the FPGA, and then the bin values are fed over to the Beagle, because it's probably not powerful enough to do all that in the Beagle board. And so how far can you zoom out and still demodulate signals?
Actually, the waveform display is a separate signal processing path from the demodulation path. So the waveform display that you see, the waterfalls, and the spectra you can see at the top of the screen, is generated by a single, a processing path that is separate from that you're listening on. So you can be listening to and the signal processing paths, there can be up to 8 of them, but each of the signal processing paths zoom in to a 6 or 10 kilohertz wide channel. So you can, one of its limitations, I think, for the Kiwis, for the space weather, is that you can get basically 8, 10 kilohertz wide signals, channels at once. That's all you can actually demodulate. You can get FFTs for the whole spectrum and see the overall signal level. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do it. But the demodulation process is limited to 8, 10 kilohertz wide channels. And they can be combined together, so you can get, convolute them together and get a 50 or 60 kilohertz, 150 or 60 kilohertz wide channel. But that's all you can do given the size of the FPGA and its ability to process, implement CIC filtering.
Okay, yeah, because I was wondering what the path was into the Beagle, because I presume the Beagle board does all the networking. So what's the path between the CAPE board and is it I2S or is it some kind of real medium speed path?
By the time the data is handed from the FPGA to the Beagle board, it's all already demodulated and so you have very low bandwidth, and I believe it's I squared S, or I don't know the answer, but it's a low bandwidth, relatively low bandwidth interconnect between the two.
Okay, well, very good then. So Nathaniel, do you know what the Jovian project is? Do they need to demodulate that 15 megahertz? It's not clear what they want to do with it. If they want to just detect the average the energy over that spectrum or what? Do you have any idea?
I don't remember exactly what they're doing with the spectra bands. So I think we'd have to look that up or ask someone.
So, Scott, you have to remember that what they're doing there is they're stitching together different segments of the bands.
You have to dodge all the terrestrial signals, so I don't think you'd want to take... In essence, that's what I do in Whisper Daemon, and my noise thing is I basically take an FFT and then throw away all of the local noise sources by knocking off the bins that have signals in them, and then I use the remaining bins as of indicators of the background noise level, and it sounds like that might be what they'd want to be doing, but on a 15 to 30 megahertz, 15 megahertz to 30 megahertz channel. Absolutely doable with the Kiwi. With the number of caveats, but the Kiwi has a marvelous API interface that allows you to do all the processing. You can extract the waterfall information and the audio signals and process it on a much more powerful host computer. And that's a super elegant solution because it's been allowed me to. I don't perturb the Kiwi's code at all, and yet I have access to all of its resources and all the demodulated audio. I was going to suggest, as an aside, one of the things I would encourage, rather than pick an HD SDR in particular to run on the personal weather station, I've been working with the various SDRs, been very impressed with the SOAPI API interface, which allows, is a driver that provides an API that allows a local or remotely located SDR software package to access the received device itself. And with the SOAPI API, you get tremendous flexibility in terms of you can talk to any variety of SDRs. There's drivers for almost everything out there. And I'd hope there would be a SOAPI driver implemented for the Tangerine. And if you do that, then you can pick, hopefully over time, more and more HDR packages will use SOAPI as their way to access the SDRs rather than talking to them directly.
I'm thinking that SOAPI might be the basis for our local protocol, and I'd like to have some extensions onto it. But that's basically what we're trying to do, is to be able to allow the single board computer software to access as much or as little of the bandwidth that it can process. So if it needed to have an FFT, it could request an FFT. If it wanted to do the DSP processing within the PC, probably not in an N2, but maybe in a desktop PC, it could request raw data. So you can request whatever format you want and whatever bandwidth you want. So you could theoretically, on a Tangerine with the interface bandwidth that we've come up with, you could send 15 megahertz of demodulatable data over the the Gig E or the USB 3. And, you know, hope you got a powerful computer on the other end, but because you need one. But the point is that you can get the raw data that way if you wanted.
Could you spell that? Is SOPY, S-O-P-I?
S-O-P-Y, I think.
Yeah, S-O-A-P-Y, I think.
Oh, SOPY, right. Okay.
Yeah,
the package is called SOPY SDR, and it's actually in the Lin HP SDR program that I was trying to get running on the N2, and it really is the holdup. It doesn't run very well on small single board computers, so I have to probably do a little bit of optimization or at least cut back some feature stuff to make it work.
My problem with the SOPY was not the SOPY part. It was finding, I was trying to run new radio. I forget the other one. There's a Cubic or something, SDR. I was trying to get to be able to talk to SDR Play or RTL SDR on my Raspberry Pi 3. And I could barely get it to work. I mean, it just ran 90%+ CPU, but all of that CPU cycles was consumed by the program generating the windows and scrolling windows and all that other stuff. The demodulation part of it is nothing, you know. That's easy to do computationally. So I don't think SOPY would be a performance imperative. I can imagine that it could be an issue in terms of it's oriented toward getting demodulated signals rather than raw data, but in other respects the API seems to be I thought it was pretty elegant and it partitions functionality between the receive device and the demodulation and display device, I think in a way that's appropriate for from my perspective as a software architect, I think it's the right partition.
Well, if we had a try to run SOPY, we would have to have something running on the FPGA, on the Tangerine board itself, on the DE, and then you would actually run the SOPY API on the single board computer. Is that what you're trying to do, Dan?
Yes.
So how does the SOPY API talk to the single board or talk to the raw data? How does it get the raw data?
Well, that's a SOPY. There's a server component and a client component to SOPY. The server runs on the receive device, and in this case, it'd be running on your Odroid, and it talks to your hardware. And the API, the SOPY server's API, responds to requests from SOPY clients, which can be local on the same machine or remote, you know, across the LAN or WAN. And delivers the client, which typically is a HDSDR or some SDR program, then uses that to interact with the user. So you would only need to implement the server side and of SOPY, and have it running on your Odroid. It's very lightweight. I mean, the SOPY server consumes 2 or 3% of a Pi 3 CPU, almost nothing.
Okay, but the SOPY server that runs on the single board computer has to get its raw data from our FPGA board somehow.
Yes.
So, and there's a protocol to do that, and there's some, so the server software, I'm sure, has then the front end piece that talks to the hardware. What protocol is that? What does it use?
I don't know. I've not implemented that, so I can't tell you. But that's supporting process is you have to wire up the SOPY server so that it, you know, API calls from clients then get translated into interaction with your specific hardware and generate, you know, I haven't done. I'm only a user of that stuff. I haven't looked into the implementation, but there seem to be. There's SOPY servers for the, of course, the RTL SDRs and for the AirSpy and the HackRF and the SDR Plate, and all those have SOPY servers implemented for them.
Okay, so as the FPGA guy, I'm going to have to implement that piece that goes in the actual hardware. And I think all those SDRs you mentioned, I don't think any of them have FPGAs, so they must have some standard protocol. They just spit out the IQ data, and then the server, SOAPI server, processes it and does what it needs to do.
I don't think the server does. Is not responsible for the for processing, doing demodulation or anything. I shouldn't speak. This is we're now beyond my understanding of SOAPI, and I think it warrants some. Some research.
Scotty, it appears that there are drivers for each radio platform that communicate in a SOAPI protocol.
And okay, John Melton's Lynn HPSDR has the, or Lynn SD, whatever he calls it, actually has the HPSDR protocol 1 and protocol 2 drivers with it.
Okay, so the SOAPI API accepts HPSDR protocol 1 and 2, and ideally it would accept our local protocol 2.
Correct.
That's if we wanted to write it.
Correct, and SOAPI set up for not everybody write, not all the drivers are written by one person, so people like the Line Suite have written a driver, a HackRF. I noticed that there are modules that read Red Pitaya and making real quick remote SDR and some others. So if you, I did put the link for the SOAPI SDR website, GitHub, on there, and it has some help pages to understand what's going on.
Yeah, so it looks like we'd have to do a device module to reside on the Tangerine.
Yes. Yes, I believe that's true.
Sounds like that's doable. But Dan, you said you're having trouble getting it to run on the N2. Is it because of resources or just because of dependencies?
It's because of resources. I got the dependency problem solved. I went to Ubuntu Mate.
So that's interesting, because the theory is that the server should be kind of lightweight.
Yeah, I had it running on a Pi 3 talking to a SDR Play. Yep, worked just fine. I mean, it, as I say, Pi 3B was about 90% busy. But when I went off and did a direct call from my Mac as the running the client and talking to SOAPI server on the Pi, talking to the SDR Play, the Pi was maybe 8% busy while I was. So I inferred from that 80% of the CPU time, or 90% of the CPU time on the Pi was on the client side, not on the SOAPI server and driver side.
Okay, thanks. I understand that now. Good.
Anyway,
so, Rob, what we have to do to collaborate here with Fred?
If you're ready to talk to him, I can make an introduction and suggest. If you're ready to collaborate, then I'd be happy to facilitate, organize a conference call, introductory thing to. Ill-equipped technically to talk about polyphase filters and FPGAs that I wouldn't know what to ask of him beyond saying I know that this could be valuable to us. So if you wanted to suggest a time, Fred is out here in San Diego, so it would be West Coast centric, and I'm available. Most mornings, not so much. Well, actually, I should say it'd be Wednesday through Friday would be best mornings for me to do it. or any time during those days. So if you want to do it, is this Scotty who's
Yeah, this is Scotty. And maybe I'm a little premature here because I'm really kind of buried with doing the hardware. But once that gets done and it's on the road, then the FPGA is the next task. And, you know, defining the protocol and writing the FPGA code. And interestingly enough, I'm going to be out in San Diego this Friday for about half a day.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I can send Fred a note and introduce him to you and say that we're definitely interested in exploiting and implementing his code in, as part of our project. And if he had had, if you have some time on Friday, maybe you guys could get together. I don't know. I've never met him in person. I've only had some conference calls with him. But seems like a very affable person, and he's a emeritus professor at so I don't know what his academic responsibilities are anymore, so I don't know how much flexibility he has with his life, but I was impressed by how open he was to helping us, so that was gratifying to me.
Yeah, that sounds great. If you want to touch base with him and see, I don't really want to push too hard for this Friday because I'm not really that ready, and I don't want to give him a false alarm. But yeah. I mean, if we want to just get together and I can fill him in on the project, if you haven't done that already, and you know, just meet him once.
Okay. Well, I'll send Fred an email tomorrow morning and thank him and suggest, you know, that we would like to have occasion to talk with him. And mention you'll be out there in person for a brief. But I don't know, if you only have half a day in San Diego, it can take all of that to get from one side of town to the other. So not may not be practical.
Yeah, UCSD, is that kind of like on the northeast side?
Yes, it's on the ocean. It's on the northwest. It's on the northwest part. It's actually, you know, it's north-south there pretty much. So the Pacific Ocean is to the west. So it's just north of town. It's a relatively convenient to the airport. The airport's downtown. It's 15 to 20 minutes. So. But he's at San Diego State. So if he's still doing office hours, that's kind of in the east side of town. So it's not close to UCSD. They're separate. That's the University of California. It's separate from the San Diego State University. They're both reputable institutions, but at different branches of the state school system.
Oh, I thought he was at UCSD. No. Anyway, I'm going to Carmel Valley. I don't know if you know anything. If you're from there, you probably know where that is.
Carmel Valley is in Northern California. The one I know of. I don't know San Diego that well, so I'm sure they have a Carmel Valley too. I think that's where Qualcomm is. This the Qualcomm area, and there's a tech corridor there, kind of north of inland from UC San Diego. There's a corridor where there's a lot of where Qualcomm and a whole constellation of other tech firms are quartered.
Yeah, it's only just a few miles north of I-5 and I-8 is where I'm going. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in any case, I'll just, you know, we'll see what, you know, how he would like to proceed. But I think this is a great interest to me. I think the technology he has is extraordinarily valuable, commercially valuable. And I think he's had a hard time kind of demonstrating its value to the commercial radio community. And so this implementation could be valuable to him, if we could demonstrate that it, the benefits it brought to our project, he might gain from that, and our industry would gain from it. I mean, the big thing for me is that if we could actually see a better signal, you know, improved signal noise ratio through the use of it, that to me is a big deal. 2 dB improvement in fundamental signal noise in a radio system to me is a huge deal.
Well, it didn't take me but about 5 minutes to see the value, so
well, good. I'm I'm really gratified that you share that insight. Unfortunately, I even went and talked to a few VCs on this about his technology, and they just don't get it. You know, I'm sitting here in Silicon Valley, and it's like they do not see it. But of course, VCs aren't really technologists; they're money men. So.
And we'll have to show them.
Well, this is an opportunity to do that, and so that would be a benefit to Fred. And I'd be happy to help him. The whole thing is interesting to me, so I'm happy to see whoever can benefit from it. I think it's great.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Yeah, let me know what he says, and we'll go.
Okay. Well, do I your email is someplace, right, Scotty?
I'll put it at the bottom down here, but I'm plastered everywhere.
Okay. I'll look around to find it. I don't have it elsewhere, but yeah, that's good. And I wanted to thank Mike for putting up my lightning talk. I've already had a whole host of my friends out here applauding my performance, which I find somewhat appalling to see myself in person. And, you know, but that's others seem to, my friends and wife seem to think I look okay. So I came off okay. So looking forward to the rest of it and to seeing the presentation, since there's a number of them. I didn't get like the solar presentation. I didn't get the links and so on that I was hoping to get. So I'm looking forward to seeing the actual presentations themselves from the conference.
Yeah, they're going to be up pretty soon. I've got all of them on a thumb drive here. I just have been buried since I got back. But yeah. It's like you never watch your own videos, just like you never go into the kitchen of your favorite restaurant.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you never want to listen to yourself. It's painful but necessary if you're going to be doing presentations. So
it's bad enough if I make other people listen to me.
So yeah, I'm interested in the reference. So to reiterate, what interests me is the reference antenna calibration stuff. So I guess that was Ned who was talking about that. So any links to that information would be helpful to me.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't. I don't have a way to publish that. Maybe I can get some web space from ARL to post the procedure and sort of the results. It's a work in progress. I mean, I work to calibrate the antennas that I have, and they're unique and different than what's with the space weather project, but the approach should be the same. The setup would be unique to that, and I could probably rerun that here on my antenna lab in my backyard here, because before I went out to the remote site, I ran a calibration of some receive antennas I have here at home. So it might work out, but it might be pretty easy. But you need a reference antenna, or maybe one that spawns a bunch of other transfer standards or something like that, so that it can. So you don't have to keep shipping this one antenna to everybody who wants to do this.
Well, this has been a sticking point with us for since the beginning, is calibrated antenna patterns and gains and things like that. So one of the things we are going to try to do is stick with one particular brand or type of antenna, one build, but that doesn't even really do it, because it depends on how it's installed. So If you'd like to put some documents up on the Tangerine side, I think Nathaniel and the group would be very interested in seeing that.
Okay, and, if you have a couple of different types of antennas that you might recommend for these packages, then maybe I can we can talk about running a kind of a test on them and come up with some estimates of their behavior.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And if we come up with some standard antennas, you know, even the commercial antennas, we could say, well, buy this antenna, and then you can calibrate it using this procedure. That I think that would be reasonable.
Yeah, being an RF dude, you wish you could see RF, or you wish others could see what you see, because it's complicated. Like, for example, this R main receive antenna system, these beverage antennas are vertically polarized antennas. The loop, this EMCO 6502 loop, is a polarized antenna. I mean, it to get measure a total field, you have to orient it in X, Y, and Z and come up with a kind of a vector sum of the three fields to get the total field. But to use it as a antenna, you got to make sure it's oriented to respond to the vertical to the same polarization as the test antenna under test, and the source that you use to set up the lab, it also has to have the same polarization, so everything is measuring the same thing. So it gets a little tricky making sure you get it set up right.
Yeah, okay, but that's definitely something that we could figure out, and then if we could present that in a reasonably simplistic way. I mean, what we do is we probably Nathaniel would decide what he wants to measure, and then we say, okay, orient the antenna this way to measure that.
That's what I did. I mean, I set up the source, and I went out in the backyard of my range here and oriented the loop in the three directions, and I quickly determined that how to orient it so it was vertical. It's about 16 dB cross-polarization sensitivity. I mean, it responds 16 dB lower when it's on the wrong polarization. So it was pretty clear which way it had to be aligned to make sure it was responding to primarily to vertically polarized signals.
Okay, one other thing. When I talked to Ed Hare at Hamvention, and he asked me what he could do to help us promote the Tangerine, and I told him all the capabilities that we're planning, and he got pretty interested, and he was talking about maybe how ARL could help get the word out, blog or an information page or I don't know what all is available through the ARL, but I sent him a couple email messages and I haven't gotten any response. But then I sent a couple email messages to Kai, the editor of QEX, and I finally got hold of him, and he wasn't getting my other email messages. So maybe if there's a different email address for Ed that I could use to talk to him, that he might actually get the email.
Probably not. He's overloaded. This antenna calibration thing, I was actually thinking about writing a paper for QEX, and now that you mentioned this, maybe we should have a series of papers and kind of combine, kind of come up with a thread here that serves both purposes, both our noise study project and the space weather project using Tangerine.
Yeah, because Kai wants me to start the hands-on SDR column up again, so he wants something every couple issues. Of course, if I was the editor, I would want that too, but that's okay. But I'm not really qualified to write an article like what you're talking about, but certainly we could have them in the same issue that would be compatible and cross-reference each other.
Yeah, kind of complement each other more like so that, you could get into depth on this topic and that topic and not have to kind of tiptoe around things on every single paper, kind of show an overall scheme of where we're going to talk about these things and then start with, because I have a lot of questions about, the receiver. I mean, I was talking earlier about my technical concerns with the total power going into your first nonlinear device inside your radio is very interesting, and that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where performance stops most of the time, and you got to know where that is and what you have to do to avoid it. That area is very interesting to me, and it's why I don't have SDR radios here, because none of them that are out there live in the environment that I live in with all the big antennas that I use. You really need to operate in narrow band mode, and having wide band receivers is interesting, but it takes a different architecture to exploit their value. You got to make sure you're controlling what it is they're seeing.
Yeah, and of course, this radio is intended primarily, the first use of it is going to be broadband. So it's kind of hard to put preselectors and filters on when you want to receive the whole band and process it. But it also has a narrowband use too. So I'm very interested in what you have to say, because I would like to be the first SDR that you could set up at your location that would meet your requirements.
Yeah, well, where we are is probably as quiet as I can't remember the name of the place, but yeah, the only way to control the power is to walk away from the high power sources. I was working on DF systems for the military, and I had to find a valley here in Arizona and set up a range in a valley so I could get away from all the TV and FM stations. It's just a problem. You gotta look at that issue before you You know, before you start to characterize systems. Otherwise, you're struggling with artifacts. Most of what you're getting is not real.
You have to move to Green Bank.
Yeah, and you know, at KPH, I initially struggled with that. But, it can fry eggs on some of the signals coming off of the, you know, our Marconi T. We'll get, you know, plus 10 dBm kind of signal levels from some of our AM stations. But, I have an AM band high pass filter in front of the Kiwis, and the Kiwi reports if there's a single overload in the six every second in the 66 mega samples, if there's a single overload event, it'll flag it. And I rarely see any. I mean, with, you know, once I got rid of the AM band.
Yep, that's the culprit. That's the biggest one. Hey, guys, I have to run to my other telecon, but good to catch up with you all. I'll see you next week.
Okay. Good.
Thanks, Ned.
All right, good night.
7-3, Ned.
Hey, Rob, I wanted to say to you, and I guess no one else is interested, myself and a number of the other scientists were planning on being at the AGU meeting in San Francisco December 9th through 16th, I believe. And Rob, since you're right in San Francisco, you might want to stop by at some point.
That'd be great. I'd love to. In fact, there was who was I talking to? Somebody was talking about doing a presentation there on some of this, but I couldn't see. We couldn't be ready for any. We didn't feel like we had anything that was published quality. I mean, we have, there's a lot of. We're still calibrating our systems so we're not ready for publication, but I'd love to attend the event. It seems like there's some interesting talks being. I guess I should sign up to attend the. But I've kind of forgotten about that whole thing. But I'll be around. I'm going to be here, so I'd love to come over and see you guys. We get together. I could take you out to KPH maybe show you the site if you want to get out of town for an afternoon.
That might be really cool. Maybe we can keep User talking about it. I'll be on a tight schedule this year, but maybe if we plan enough ahead of time, that might be really valuable. I know that David Kasdan, he's giving a talk on the low-cost version of the Personal Space Weather Station on Thursday. Actually, he has a poster, And I'm giving a talk, pretty much the same talk he gave at Tapper on Friday. And then there's going to be a lot of other ionospheric science talks at the same time and throughout the week. It should be quite a good program. And usually one night we have a ham sci get together for dinner. So yeah, maybe we could do like I could go to KPH. I'd have my wife Rachel and our son Anthony with me too. Maybe we could go to that one day, and then we can. Maybe do dinner with the ham radio people at night one night.
That'd be great. The KPH is typically open only on Saturday afternoons. And I might be able to arrange for us to go out on some other time, but if that works, give me enough if Saturday doesn't require any planning. Saturday afternoon doesn't require any planning. It is an hour and a half each way to get out there. It's a beautiful drive, and you'll see part of Northern California that is largely pristine. I mean, and especially out there at KPH, but it's like, you know, what it was when Drake first arrived here in 1564. But it's a wonderful, wonderful a day trip out of San Francisco. Especially if the weather's good, which, it depends. December, we could have rain. But in any case, I'd be happy to do that. I'll be around, and I'll plan on attending as much as I can. So my schedule's open during that period. So I'll look forward to seeing you guys.
Rob, I thought you were in San Diego. You're in San Francisco?
I'm in San Francisco, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, and Nathaniel, what was that conference, the name of the conference again?
It's the Fall American Geophysical Union Conference. There's like 40,000 scientists that go to this thing.
Yeah, and you think DCC is an overload, right?
Oh yeah, this thing is very intense.
Nathaniel, here's 88OXT. I got your email, and the answer is heck yes.
All right, well, let's try to make that happen. But tell Nathaniel Vishner that he has to get that thing squared away, because that's holding up resources.
All right, I'll check in with him about it.
That's great. Peer pressure.
So, Christina, how's the WWV project going?
Well, at the moment, the next thing on my list is downloading and sorting through all of the data that was collected from the Festival of Frequency Measurement. We had on the order of 50 data sets. Some 40 plus of these were uploaded to Zenodo, but I have not yet had time to sit down and play with the Zenodo API and get all of these into one file so that I can go in and actually analyze them. One of the things that Rob and I have been talking about is, in the longer term, putting together a web form so that people can submit these. And we're also going to be working on adding some features to the analysis.cpp and FLVG and proposing that as a patch to add certain things. Well, Rob, anything to add?
You mentioned earlier to me that a lot of people really did not like the idea of uploading, signing up to upload a thing. And so, user accounts, it becomes a lot easier, although it's nice to get other identifying information like all kinds of data. So that would,
you're kind of fading there. You're kind of fading away from the mic there.
Sorry, we're crowding around a cell phone here. But something Christina said to me earlier was a lot of people emailed the data sets to David88Y. Because they didn't like the idea of signing up for Zenodo. So probably coming up with their own submission form would be nice, just to make it trivial for people to send something up without having to sign up for another stupid website.
Yeah, pretty much. I think Zenodo, I definitely like the principles behind it, for sure. I wonder if it would be better if we collect the data on another website and then periodically upload that to Zenodo. Where we have multiple data sets together. But I haven't had enough time on Zenodo to know what's typical for recording and uploading data sets. So it'll take me a little bit of time to get that data looked at and analyzed. The good news is that we got a lot of people taking data, and that it was a very popular thing to discuss at the gathering, that, you know, even as we were meeting and talking with people, that WWV was in active use as a beacon station, and people were doing science off of it.
Okay, and the Zenodo thing you're talking about, I'm not familiar with that. Is it a data collection site or what?
Yes, Nathaniel will have more to say about this than I do, but it's an open science site that includes things like, I believe people submit papers and things on there, and then one of the other things that you can do is you can upload data sets. So sort of in the name of repeatability and completeness in science publication, it's an open science site, and if you have some data set that you're drawing conclusions off of, one of the things you can do is you can have it uploaded on there, and then you can refer people to it.
Okay, I think you told me about this, Nathaniel. This is the open publishing site you're telling me about?
Yeah, that's right. It's actually run by CERN, and one of the nice things about it is it's supposed to be a very long-term repository, and it's supposed to be indexable. So one of the requirements we're supposed to have is a data management plan that says, where do we keep the data in perpetuity and make it still accessible? And Zenodo is trying to answer that problem for people that don't have good institutional repositories. So if you're publishing a paper and you need to archive the data set somewhere to go along with the paper and make it permanently accessible, Zenodo is supposed to provide that sort of reliability. And as I said, it's run through CERN.
I like that. There's a lot of value in that approach.
Yeah, and that's why I'm a little hesitant to go away from it and to go to our own web form, because we just won't have that sort of backing or robustness. So at least until I see a better option, what I might say is if you do have those people that don't want to submit, who don't want to sign up for Zenodo, maybe first thing to do is explain why we're using it. And maybe they'll be more amenable to using it when they start to understand some of the reasons why we're doing it. And then if they still don't want to do it, you can have them send it to you and then you can upload it. And then still over 40 people, I think, have submitted to Zenodo on their own. And so if you only had 10 people not to submit to Zenodo on their own, that's still a tremendous reduction in your workload because 40 people did submit their data. It's also worth noting that the Zenodo cap is 50 gigabytes per data set, which is quite high, I think.
Okay, so I'm just going to mention that 20% of everybody not being willing to upload to Zenodo is pretty significant. And what we'd want is actually having that web front end end up uploading to Zenodo anyway. It's just an alternative that lowers the barrier to entry effectively for submitters.
That sounds acceptable to me.
Cool. Yeah, what I'm thinking would be a good idea would be if we had something where people submit on our web front end, we consolidate that data, and then submit all of that as one large data set that contains the data and the data pedigree. So no information about what's getting collected would actually be lost if we're the ones doing the consolidating. And it'll all be on there.
Yeah, that sounds fine. I think as long as it gets up to Zenodo or some sort of, repository like that, I think that's good. And yeah, if you had a different front end to do it, I don't see a problem with that.
That sounds good to me, and I'm happy to continue with Zenodo as our long-term repository stuff. I really like that idea.
Sounds good to me, and it's very well accepted, I'd say, by the science community right now.
Just Zmodo, Zebra Modo.
I'll post a link.
And I should note for those who are looking at that link, you go through there and you can just search everything that's on Zenodo for the string WWV. You should find, at least if you filter out things that are from the past couple of weeks, all of data for the Festival of Frequency Measurement that has been uploaded on there.
Yeah, I've been gathering data from my whisper daemons and logging the noise data up to an influx database that I have on a Google instance. And that data sets, I've got 20 or 30, contributors, and I've got 3 or 4 months there. It's not that large yet, but, I'm trying to figure out long-term where I want to put this data so that it doesn't disappear when Google hiccups or something. So if I will look into that.
Hey Rob, I just found my copy of Multi-Rate Signal Processing, Fred's book. And if you've we'll buy one online. They start at $250 because they're out of print.
Whoa! Ooh. Yeah, I this is not a subject I know much about, but I was, I would feel fortunate to have to come in contact with Fred. So it's a.
Yeah, I think I'll bring the book along. Have him autograph it for me. I can't believe it. I mean, the price is really for a used one. You could pay $300-$400 if you really have to have one.
Well, so you studied it, so you'd come well prepared.
Okay, so I took the book out of my bookshelf and I opened it up and I looked to see where the bookmark is. It's on page 30.
That sounds like
that tells you how far I got into it.
Well, let's hope he can mentor us through the process. I think You know, one possibility is I think he does have has some graduate students, and perhaps he might be able to enlist our project for as a project for one of his graduate students. I don't know that to be possible, but I think he was going to do that and use them on some project, so maybe ours could benefit.
Well, I'm definitely interested in implementing some of his filter algorithms in FPGA, so if he's having trouble getting people to believe the performance, this would be interesting to him then.
Yeah.
Certainly interesting to me, I can tell you that. It's to meet the guy who has the heavy math background. I mean, I got a master's degree in double E from a long time ago, but this guy's a genius.
Yeah, you're right. Well, good. I'm glad you appreciate him and ability. I am know so little of this. I hesitate. I don't want to mislead anyone into working on something that would be unproductive. But I think you know enough more than I do to suggest that this would be useful to pursue.
I know enough to be dangerous.
Well, that's great. That'd be great. So. Yeah, we could end up with, part of the problems that I see with a lot of the SDRs, and this is true for the Kiwi, is that a lot of them, end up outputting, 16-bit audio. So, and then handing that off to some, processing algorithm. 16-bit audio is, something less than 90 dB, and the signal ranges that we're capturing are significantly greater than that. So the, with the decimation, that comes with the 14-bit converters, we're looking at signals that are at -160. And the presence of -30 dB signals. So, so we end up with filters in front of our.
Yeah, because you're not going to get 130 dB of dynamic range out of an ADC.
Well, we're looking at signals and this is the part I don't entirely understand is that, we are detecting signals. The minimum signals we can detect are on the order of 100 minus 160. And those are in presence of signals that are, AM carriers that if you tune to them are minus 30. So it's a 14-bit converter, but it's also a, it's running at 66 megahertz, and your decimation, as I understand it, you get dynamic range gain from the oversampling downsampling that is associated with it. And
yes, and you will get that, but you still can't get around the saturation voltage on the input.
You cannot. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. So when you get plus 10 dBm at the antenna, you got to deal with that first.
Well, I do. I've dealt with that now well enough that I in contrast to what I think it was Ned who said earlier, I actually, at KPH, I don't really have overload problems. I mean, got the right filters, but the kind of filters you can buy, from RTLSDR, the kind of commercially made ones are not up to the task of putting in front of a high quality SDR. We custom wind and designed these filters, and so they're not really commercially available, but they are constructible from real materials, and they do work quite well.
Yeah, and I think that's what Ed was saying, is that he hasn't met an SDR that was really done the way to his liking or to his needs. So, but again, I don't know. Have you considered writing a QEX article on your project there at KPH?
No one's asked me to. I did a presentation at PacificCon last year on KPH installation, and so I have a PowerPoint that I can show to people, and I might even be giving something. I think I'll probably do the presentation to you guys. I've offered to do a PacificCon, which is our regional ARRL convention. It's coming up later this month, so I'll be out there. If somebody bails out, then the organizer has asked me to step in, so I'm ready with the presentation.
This would be more of an article for the magazine, so take some massage of your PowerPoint, but I think it would be of interest to lots of people.
Well, let me finish cleaning the site up. We've got another few months of work there to get rid of all the final birdies and ground loops and IMD sources, and then all. I get 10, 12 people listening simultaneously now, so it seems to be it's getting some attention, and
might even be good for a QST article, because they don't really need to be so technical to listen.
No, it does. No. All you need to do is know how to open a web page, and you're on air listening. That's all.
All right, it sounds great. Well, we're over about 20 minutes. I try to keep these to about an hour if we can. So, anything else? I still encourage you to write that article. I think it would be appreciative.
Are you involved in the publication process there? Who would I contact?
I can send you the guy's name. Kai Siwak is the guy's name, KE4PT. I'm not involved in the publication other than I've done a few hands-on SDR columns over the years, and Kai wants me to start it back up again. So I always like the magazine. I'm always looking for content that I think people would be interested in. Your stuff is definitely that.
Oh, good. Well, then, sure. I mean, I'd be happy to. I'd love to share this, the work and share the site to people, because people say right now, I get emails and people say this is the quietest received site on the West Coast. So.
Yeah, the thing is that, we're supposed to be, QEX is supposed to be up and coming and all that, and the latest state of the art. And you don't see as much SDR stuff as I think it should, that there should be in the magazine.
Well, then QEX, I don't even subscribe to it. I'm only dimly aware of it as a publication. It's down in the corner of the QSD I get every month.
Okay. They had some samples at DCC, but they probably didn't publicize that much.
Yeah. I know. I think I grabbed a couple of them. I will look through them. I saw them there, and I grabbed them from the table. So, okay. Well, you tell me who to talk to, and I'll see what they.
Very good. I'll drop you an email, and okay, I know, sorry. I have your email. So, I think everybody'd like to read that. So, and so thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your encouragement. So, and. And I'll my follow up from today's meeting is to see if I can't get you connected up with Fred Harris.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Anything else from anyone?
I think that's it for me.
Okay, 73, everybody. Talk to you in a week.
Thanks for coming by.
73.
Thanks so much. Bye. 73, everyone.
Thanks for doing the recording, Mike.